from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Learn a language has gone the advice forever, and many Americans ignored it, speaking English only. But many did not. Once, French was a baseline for sophistication. Japanese had its day with the Japanese economy, Arabic with 9/11, Chinese with the China boom. But of course, English has gone on spreading too. This hour On Point, the languages Americans are studying today, what's hot, what's not, and where they lead. Here's a couple of students taking a class through AIM Learning Language Learning Mandarin Chinese.
你好,你好,很好,很好.
And off they go. You know the work that goes into it. With us now from Washington, with a sharp eye on the trends in our language learning, is Marty Abbott, Executive Director of the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages, an organization of 12,000 language teachers from elementary through higher ed, once a high school Spanish and Latin teacher herself. Marty Abbott, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Middlebury, Vermont, Michael Geisler joins us, Vice President for Language Schools, Schools Abroad, and Graduate Schools at Middlebury College, considered one of the top colleges for foreign language study, where they offer 10 modern languages, plus Latin and Greek. Professor in Linguistics and Languages, Professor of German there. Michael Geisler, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you both. Marty, what's the trend line? Are we studying more foreign language these days or just counting on English to envelop the planet?
Well, unfortunately, Tom, we're not really studying more languages these days. Our last survey, which was funded by the U.S. Department of Education for the 2007-2008 academic year, indicated that in the K-12 level, only 18.5% of the students are engaged in learning other languages.
How does that compare with other nations around the world, Marty?
Well, as you know, most other nations around the world start language learning early and continue in a long sequence, and it is quite the norm around the world for students to grow up knowing more than one language, even three or four.
There was a flurry of concern in recent years that schools under fiscal pressure were cutting foreign language programs, elementary, middle school, high school. What's going on there now, Marty?
This is true. Programs at the elementary level have been cut. The Center for Applied Linguistics found that in a 10-year period from 1997 to 2008, the number of schools offering languages at the elementary level dropped from 31% to 25%. I believe there was some conflict for schools in terms of trying to get students ready for the high-stakes testing of the No Child Left Behind legislation. And sometimes naively they think, well, if students aren't doing well in math or language arts, in English, we'll just double that time and cut out some of the other subjects. But as we know, students who get an early start learning another language actually develop cognitive skills that allow them to do better on standardized tests.
Michael Geisler, at Middlebury College, your matriculants may self-select for young people with a particular interest in foreign languages. What languages do they come in most interested in acquiring now?
Well, they really study all the 10 languages that we offer in the summer and in the academic year as well.
Name those for us, if you'd be good enough.
Sure. We started with the German school in 1915, so I'll go in order of when the schools were established. French, Spanish, Italian, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Arabic, Portuguese, and most recently we have the School of Hebrew, which has been a great success.
So what's getting the most enrollment now?
The enrollments are growing, particularly in Arabic and Chinese. But we have solid enrollments in all the other languages as well, and we really see language teaching at Middlebury as being part of the strategic language reserve of the nation. We don't think that we should focus people on so-called critical languages, because yesterday's non-critical language could be tomorrow's critical language.
What do you mean by critical language?
So we need to have languages on a regular basis.
What do you mean by that, the critical language? What's that mean?
Critical languages are defined by either the Department of Defense or the Department of State as languages in which we have a deficit, where we don't have enough speakers or readers or writers of the language. And to be sure, we need to have more people who can speak those languages, where we have a strategic or global political interest. But we also need to have languages in all the 15 or 20 most important world languages. We need to have speakers in those languages as well.
Marty, there was a time, I think, all the way back in the Cold War Sputnik days, where the federal government actually put some real horsepower behind language learning in this country, looking to encourage it. What happened then, and what about that now? Is there a push from anywhere, or is it just an individual student's interest that determines where they're likely to turn?
You're right, Tom. Back in the days when the Russians launched Sputnik, the government poured a lot of money into language education with the National Defense Education Act, and that launched a number of speakers of Russian and other languages throughout the country. But then that kind of petered off. We saw a little bit of interest, as you mentioned, in the 80s with Japanese. And then after 9/11, we thought we had another Sputnik moment, but it didn't turn out to be that way in terms of federal funding, except with the Department of Defense. And they put a lot of money into the National Security Education Program, which supports students at the post-secondary level. But continuing with that, we in January of 2006, President Bush announced the National Security Language Initiative, and that really just repurposed some money that was already there for some language programs. But we really haven't seen that addition of money from federal sources to promote language learning in this country.
Michael Geisler, what do you say to people, maybe young people these days, who say, well, English is moving all over the world. Why spend the time to learn the foreign language when I'm going to, you know, get into business and go to Beijing and the people who show up to meet me will speak English?
Funny, I just had a conversation about that with one of our alums who is in the administration of one of the major German international companies and has a very nice position there. And he told me over dinner, he said, Michael, I have my position because I speak German. And I actually responded by saying, that's very nice. You're telling me that because you know that I represent languages. Mm-hmm. You probably have a few other qualifications. And he smiled and said, yes, I do. But when I first came to this country, there were 12 of us, 12 American expats, very qualified in business with great qualifications in other areas as well. I'm the only one left. Because, yes, it is true that Germans speak English in the boardroom, in international negotiations. They are very good at that. But what do they do afterwards? They head to the pubs. And in the pubs, they don't like to speak English any more than anyone else likes to speak a second language, an acquired language, when they're on their own free time. Mm-hmm. And guess where the networking happens? It doesn't happen in the boardroom. It happens in the pubs.
So learn the language, and you're there with the Hofbrau or whatever it may be. Marty, what do you see as the most sought-after language now, maybe before people get to the university level? Where are people putting their attention? Is Spanish still the big one? Where's Chinese? Do you rank them in terms of what's offered?
Right, we do. Overwhelmingly, it's still Spanish, Tom. 72% of the students at the K-12 level who take a language opt for Spanish. So that's still the most popular language at the K-12 level. And then down around 13% of the students still opt for French and then German and then Latin. So those strong languages are still fairly strong. And Chinese is the one that's really making strides at the K-12 level. We've seen huge increases in Chinese. I would say now probably we're up to well over 100,000 students learning Chinese at the K-12 level.
The government of China has been interested in encouraging that. Are they engaged in encouraging any of that language learning?
They are. They're actually sending teachers here to teach Chinese in the K-12 schools because sometimes a school is interested in starting a program and they don't have qualified teachers. So there is an interest on the part of the Chinese government to provide teachers and also resources. And they are also funding Confucius institutions at the post-secondary level and actually doing quite a bit to try to promote Chinese in this country.
What do you
actually
say,
all over the world.
What do you say, Marty, to people who say, well, English is all over the world, and on top of that, we've got more technology coming, we're going to hear about it later in this hour, that will help us with translation and the rest, so why put in the work?
Well, like Michael, I point to the number of jobs that are available now. The demand is incredible in the business side for speakers of other languages, and sometimes there's not even a college degree required, just the language. You know, you pull up jobs on Monster.com and you see installation and service technician, no college required, but they need to be fluent in Russian. I mean, it's incredible. And a recent survey of the Chamber of Commerce and talking about impediments to trade, not only with large corporations, but also with SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises, the top five impediments to international trade, languages was mentioned in every single case of 3,000 respondents.
Michael Geisler, what about the job market for language-ready graduates?
We have people who go into international corporations. We have people going into journalism, into communications. Keep in mind that global language skills, global skills and language skills are required by corporations and nonprofits alike. And they do go to people who speak two or three different languages. They just don't go to Americans right now. They go to Europeans or Chinese who have their own native language and English on top of that. We need Americans who can speak these other languages so that they can compete with them. And once they have those, they will find that they can go into just about any field. I also talked to another alum recently who is an international investment banker who said point blank to me, I would not hire anybody for this company who doesn't have a second language.
We're going to talk in just a couple of minutes here with somebody who's right at the heart of hiring nationally and globally about language capacity and what it means if you're looking for a job. Here's a little bit from a public school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. English-speaking children immersed in Spanish language and culture.
Russ.
En
la,
estación,
de.
Just the beginning there. Let's go to Lou in Duncan, Michigan first. Lou, you're on the air. What's your story?
Here in Baiza, Tom.
Yes, a little simultaneous translation, please.
That means good day, Tom.
Oh, in what language, Lou?
Finlander. I mean Finnish.
Finnish. Okay, you're beyond my realm there.
My daughter, when she was in high school, she's 27 almost, and she wanted to take Finnish because we have a big Finnish culture up here in the UP.
Yeah.
And she was the only person that signed up for it when it was finally offered. So she sat in a room with a... you know, like, I don't know, Skype or whatever they have.
Yes.
You know, some and there was, like, there was people from Minnesota, and then there was, you know, where all the other Finnish people were around.
You have a determined daughter there, Lou. Is she happy that she put the work in now with some Finnish under her belt?
She just loves it, because now sometimes when we're talking to some old Finlander, she knows what they're talking about. And the only things I know is... Happy New Year is Ono Lista Wotovota. I got that.
It sounds like a little short poem there, Lou. Stay on it, and I'm glad she grabbed it. Marty, what about ethnic origins as a motivation for language learning in this country? We obviously have immigrants from all over the world. Is that part of what send people out to learn, that they want to know the language of their parents, grandparents?
Yes, absolutely. And unlike the turn of the century when we were encouraging people, immigrants, to lose their native language, now the trend is to help native speakers of the language, or heritage speakers as we call them, because usually they're here already and they're just speaking the language at home. We encourage them to continue learning this language, and that means learning to read and write, which are often the skills that are left behind as people just use it to communicate in the home. And so there's very much a trend to provide programs for heritage speakers to help them become fully bilingual and biliterate in their native language.
Marty, Michael Geisler, stand by. With us right now from Chicago is John Challenger, job market workplace expert, chief executive officer at Challenger Gray & Christmas, international job placement consultant. John Challenger, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It's a globalized economy, and there are so many skills that can be used in so many places. Does language matter these days, John?
It does matter. Today, as the U.S. economy expands around the globe, as more and more our businesses depend on tapping into the markets of foreign consumers, we need employees and workers who can fit into those countries, fit into the cultures, and speak the language.
What about people coming up who say, well, that's great, but, you know, English just spreads more and more and more widely around the world. I'll just surf the English as it moves out rather than putting in the work to learn.
Well, and in fact, the opposite is happening. The English, use of English as the dominant language, is declining as other languages, and obviously the most common, as you've talked about so far, Spanish and Chinese, but many others begin to rise. So while English may still be the lingua franca, we're seeing now the emergence of countries that, when they want U.S. businesses to come in and partner with them, want people from the U.S. who speak their language.
So you're a job guy and a placement guy for parents or students thinking about where they might want to invest in job terms. What languages look like good bets now in what sectors, John?
Well, if you're, for example, it does depend on the sector. If you want to get into the petroleum industry, speaking Arabic is a good language to learn with the dominance of that industry in the Middle East, so you can't lose that way. With the growth of Brazil, Portuguese is a new language that companies with large operations in Brazil or companies that want to tap into that market need Portuguese speakers from the U.S. Who can fit in. So it does depend on your interests, but there are many languages. Now, interestingly, Spanish is a language that has another advantage. In Brazil and the U.S., it's the second most spoken language, and so having that language also allows you to use it in more than just Spanish-speaking countries.
So how do you advise young people if they're, I don't know, if they're looking at taking another computer science class or another international relations class or diving into, you name it, Chinese, Urdu, you know, is it one or the other or both, you're saying, John?
Well, today, language, and it's interesting you bring up the computer language, because I do think that's just as important. But today, learning language that allows you to fit in today's global technological economy is crucial to your upbringing. I can think of one college president who said two generations ago, to pass, you had to swim a length of the pool to prove you could manage that. Today, we want to see that you know another language or that you've spent a semester sometime abroad living in another country.
John Challenger at Challenger Gray and Christmas in Chicago, CEO there. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Michael Geisler, I don't know if you make the career argument primarily at Middlebury. Do you, or is it something else? Is it about learning the perspective that another language gives you on reality?
I think understanding another culture and how another culture looks at your culture, because it's both ways, is really just as important. And when it comes to selecting a language, I actually advise students not to just look at where everyone is going right now. For instance, Japanese for a while was not taken by that many students because everyone was flocking to Arabic and Chinese and Spanish. And Japanese is still one of the world's major economies. So right now, if you take a language in another area where not everybody else is going, you might actually have an advantage because you won't have the kind of competition. So you should really take the language that you're interested in, that you feel passionate about, a culture that you care about or that you read about. And of course, language learning is not a goal in itself, an end in itself. You should go to the country for at least a semester, ideally for a year, to really understand how people are thinking over there. And for that, your passion is the best guide, because there are jobs for speakers of all languages.
Anna's calling from Litchfield, New Hampshire. Anna, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on. Mm-hmm. I'm a Spanish teacher to 8th grade students this year, and I myself was born in Russia. So I've had a lot of very interesting language experience, but I have to say my 9 years of teaching, this is the first year that not a single student has asked, why do we have to, you know, learn this in Spanish? We're not going to use it, or everybody speaks English. So it's been a very nice transition, because I feel like 9 years ago when I started teaching.
That's a long time to wait for enthusiasm. Why do you think it's changing, Anna? What's your analysis?
I would say that they're seeing, you know, I have a lot of students whose parents are traveling to Central America for business, who are hearing, now I teach in a district that's fairly middle class and not very diverse, but we live near a big city, so there are a lot of Spanish speakers there, so they are hearing it around, and so I think they're just realizing, like, hey, this is, it's all around me. And I have to say that they're very excited when they learn that I was born in Russia, because my mother tongue is Russian. So they're very excited to know that people do know other languages, and they always ask me, so in Spain, do they have to learn how to conjugate English verbs?
Yes, they do.
I've seen a big turnaround. Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Anna, you've got them going global, and I appreciate your call. Marty, what about on Spanish? Do you see people, it's still the biggest. Is that because people think, well, I'm going to be traveling in Latin America? Is it because that's what we've thought of as a foreign language that people anticipate they're going to be using here at home in the United States?
Yes, that's true. I think Spanish is popular because students see the most immediate use for it. Usually in their communities, there are Spanish speakers, and so they think it's immediately usable. What they don't know is once they leave the United States, languages like French, for example, are very commonly spoken around the world. And so I think that's our, you know, naivete here in the United States. There's also a feeling that Spanish is easy. And so I think some students enroll in Spanish because they think it's going to be easier. And we know as you get into the upper levels, it's a fairly complex language. So there are lots of different reasons. Our tack at the K-12 level is please just study any language, because what we know the research shows is that you can add another language more easily. And say at the college level, you can switch languages and you have a much, much easier time when it's the third language you're learning.
Marty Abbott, Michael Geisler, please stand by. Nicole Wilson joins us now from San Francisco. Nicole is Vice President of Language Learning Products at Rosetta Stone. Very popular for language learning. They offer 34 languages. Nicole, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You work with Americans and around the world. Where do you see in the world the biggest demand for foreign language learning?
Well, I think echoing what Marty said earlier, we definitely see a huge demand for Spanish, and English is obviously incredibly huge and growing rapidly. We also have a lot of popularity of French, Italian, German, Spanish. Mandarin is getting a lot of attention. Russia, with the Olympics coming up, we're seeing an increased interest in Russian.
Where's the biggest interest in English language coming from, Nicole?
Oh, all over the world, especially emerging economies like Brazil, Turkey, China, South Korea.
And when you look at your American business, what does it tell you about Americans' interest in foreign language learning and what languages it's tending toward?
Well, I think now more than ever, people feel connected to the rest of the world. I think with the increased availability, speed, and reliability of the internet, people are able to connect instantaneously with anyone from around the world, and that facilitates the ability to practice and become fluent in a language like never before, and at a much lower cost.
Have we, Rosetta Stone started out as a really software-oriented, and I think you've increasingly, I'm reading here from not so long ago, not pushing just the software angle so much, but getting into the classroom. What's the trend in instruction that you see, Nicole?
Well, a lot of people don't know that Rosetta Stone was actually created as a tool for educators. And we started out in the classroom, and we're used in tens of thousands of classrooms in K-12 and higher ed. And the most ideal application of our product is in a blended learning solution. That means it's combined with expert teachers and used as a way for teachers to augment and supplement their reach.
Let's go to Bill in Johnson, Vermont, maybe calling for you, Nicole. Bill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Tom. I wanted to put a pitch in and ask a question. I'll put a pitch in for Hebrew because, among other things, Israel has incredible science, technology, medical labs, and all kinds of opportunity. They're also fast becoming one of the world's newest and largest energy exporters. So there's a lot of opportunity there, but also to understand straight-up history, and if you're a Christian or a Jew, certainly cultural and biblical history.
Do you speak it, Bill? Are you learning it?
For Hebrew. You know what? Here's my question. As an adult learner with many false starts behind me, I wondered if any of your guests could suggest a method or a system, not by brand name, that kind of overcomes that obstacle for adult learners to their first, second language.
Nicole, I'll take it to you. Are we evolving in our understanding of how adult learners might best approach a second language?
absolutely, research in the area of language acquisition is in its infancy in some sense. I mean, we're learning more every day. We do offer Hebrew, by the way. And in terms of what is facilitating that growth in understanding how people learn languages, large amounts of data coming from millions of learners around the world can really accelerate our understanding of what works, what's effective, and what doesn't work.
So what have you learned that's more effective that you might, what's new under the sun about learning a language? Isn't it just work, work, work?
Definitely not. Language is really about communication. It's about negotiating meaning in real time with other speakers. It was historically treated more like a collection of abstract rules and symbols that one had to commit through to memory through kill and drill, rote memorization. Mm-hmm. And that approach is actually absolutely ineffective and resulted in many people coming out of high school. You didn't hear that story. I took 4 years of Spanish in high school, and you know, I can't even order a meal at a restaurant. And that's because previous methods of instruction weren't really tapping into the social nature of language and helping the brain recognize, this isn't just a set of things to memorize. This is about communication and letting that part of the brain take over. So I think an increased use in a communicative approach has yielded tremendously positive results. And being able to provide the right content to the right learner at the moment they need it, which is facilitated by technology, is another key to really optimizing that learning experience and getting the most bang for your buck for every hour you put in learning.
Nicole, we're going to hear about some technology that's coming into translation in just a minute. Is it possible that software will put you guys out of business, that will just wear something around our neck, speak through it, you know, English in and Swahili out?
You know, I get that question fairly often, and who's to say, you know, what's going to exist in 100 years? But I don't think there's any threat to our business in the near future. I think Michael really nicely articulated it earlier, the anecdote about being in the pub and just networking with people after you have those meetings in the boardroom. And that's where the real action is. Language is about connecting with other people. And when you put a device in between two people and a delay, even in milliseconds, between the communicative exchange, it hinders that feeling.
Nicole Wilson, Vice President of Language Learning Products at Rosetta Stone, joining us from San Francisco there. Nicole, thank you very much. Marty Abbott, please stand by. Michael Geisler at Millbury College. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about foreign language learning in the USA, what's hot, what's not, and where language study leads now. There, a student at the Center for International Learning in Oman reciting a poem she wrote in English and translated into Arabic led her to Oman. Clive Thompson joins us now from New York, a contributing editor at Wired magazine, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive Thompson, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here, Tom.
So I'm looking at an essay written by the former president of Harvard University, Larry Summers, just a couple of years ago, where he's saying, well, look, here's what you really need to learn in college now. And among the things he said there, and it was controversial at the time, perhaps still, was that it's not so important to learn language anymore, in part because we're going to have mechanical text translation that will make that easier. Technology is going to come in and obviate the need for foreign language learning. Are we on an arc toward anything like that, Clive?
Well, there's two questions here. One is, he's right that machine translation, automatic translation, is getting enormously better than it used to be. They used to, back in the old days, they try and figure out a language, figure out the rules, teach the machine the rules. Too hard to do. There's just too many weird rules, particularly with a language like English. So what they do now is they just do statistical crunching. They take a sentence that you write in Spanish or English or Russian, and they try and find out if there's already a translation of those chunks of that sentence somewhere else, and they assemble it together. And it works really well. This is why Google Translate works surprisingly well, particularly amongst the Romance languages.
Wait a minute. Describe that again. They take a language, a sentence that I've written in English,
sure.
And now how does that become German?
Well, what Google does is it looks around the world for any situations where someone, usually in government that's bilingual, has taken the same text and translated it into different languages.
Ah,
I'm Canadian.
Okay.
So up in Canada, the government by law has to take everything said in the government record, translate it into French. So Google has this fantastic record of a bunch of words or an entire sentence, what they look like in two languages. So they can break those sentences into chunks, and now when I give them a totally new English sentence, they can find different chunks of it and find exactly how those chunks were translated and put them together into a reasonably good French version of that new sentence.
I mean, still limits to that. Not so long ago, we were talking about some particular cuisine, international cuisine, and we put the recipe up, did some auto-translation through Google from a foreign language to English, and that recipe was not edible, let me tell you.
Yeah, no. And Trey, stuff like poetry, anything that uses unique, the more unique and unusual your phrasing, the less likely it's going to capture it, right? So it can work really well if you're writing a really simple email to someone. As soon as you get into complex waters, yeah, you need a real human translator in there. And I think that's the answer to the second part of the question. This is why I think Sumner's is wrong. He's right that we're seeing this great explosion of the ability to casually communicate across languages. I actually tweet with people sometimes in Spanish or German by using Google Translate. Works for simple little things. But if you want to be a fluent communicator, a fluent thinker in another language, you need to have that inside your head. That demand is not going to go away.
What about spoken language translation or interpretation, Clive? Is there anything on the horizon there, some kind of Star Trek, orb
sure.
that will hang between the two of us and take my English to your Urdu and vice versa?
Well, simply by using the technique of taking like a translated textual version and speaking it aloud, you can do a lot already. You can get these little handheld things, that you download to your iPhone. You can type in some English and it'll translate it into Spanish and speak it out to a Spanish speaker. It's harder to recognize the spoken language. Like, it's harder for a machine to listen to what you're saying and pick it apart, because the way that we speak is still a lot fuzzier and more complicated for machines to understand. Written text, that's easy. The spoken language, that's still pretty hard.
Clive Thompson, stand by in New York. Michael Geisler, you're there in Middlebury, and no doubt you all have been thinking about this. Where do you see software technology coming into this picture in a meaningful way, and what's still just going to have to be learned for effective communication across languages, Michael?
Well, I think the most useful application of software is making it possible to deploy foreign language teachers in classroom settings more efficiently, which is why we created Middlebury Interactive Languages, which actually provides software that is contextualized based on authentic materials, based on interaction with other speakers, because you cannot learn a language unless you talk to somebody else. And that's why we've created that. And that makes it possible, as does Rosetta Stone, for school districts to deploy language teachers more efficiently. Instead of getting rid of them, you can have a language teacher support several school districts and keep the language, or maybe even introduce new languages. So in that sense, I think technology can play a very large part in enabling us to keep and add to our language reservoir. In terms of speaking with people through a translator, I completely agree with you that we are long ways away from Star Trek's Universal Translator. I'd love to talk to Mr. Spock, but I'd rather do it in English or German than try to rely on the translator, because what translators can't do yet is look for context and look for semantics. A simple sentence like, "You better believe that," can have a very, very different meaning based on the inflection and the context in which it was said in different languages. And you can wind up with a translation that is technically correct, but horribly wrong and off target in the actual situation. You can embarrass yourself or even make an enemy in the process if you don't understand the role that context and inflection and voice and gestures playing a particular situation.
I think I can well imagine where you'll go with this, but what about the former president of Harvard's assertion? This is Larry Summers, no stranger to putting stuff out there that gets people going, but saying that, English emergence as a global language and machine translation, he wrote, make it less clear that the substantial investment necessary to speak a foreign tongue is universally worthwhile. He said, over time, it's going to become less essential in doing business in Asia, treating patients in Africa, helping resolve conflicts in the Middle East. Not so important, said the president of Harvard, Michael.
Well, since I'm on record as having opposed that particular statement, I think I would be repeating myself, but I'll say that I think it's a very dangerous delusion that we can rely on English entirely. We need English desperately for global competitiveness, for strategic competitiveness. We need it in politics, in all of those areas. If we don't have native speakers of different native speakers of American English who can speak different languages and speak to the hearts and minds of speakers of other languages in other cultures and can explain the American point of view, the American way of doing business, the U.S. way of delivering products in different locales, localization of business products without understanding the kinds of conversations that are going on in television shows, in newspapers, in talk shows, in those other languages. And they don't happen in English. Without that, it's very difficult to transfer the American presence abroad and represent American interests abroad.
Let's go to Joe in Melbourne, Florida. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm directing my comments more to non-traditional state students who've never considered studying another language. I took no other languages in high school, but I've been a recreational surfer for 30 years, and I can't express I think anyone who plans to travel as part of their sense of adventure or pursuit of a sport or hobby, it demonstrates such a sign of respect to people. It also opens up the opportunity for extraordinary moments that personally I would have never expected, and they far exceeded what my purpose of going to those countries was.
Like what, Joe? Where did your surfing take you?
Well, as an example, I wanted to go to Indonesia, a mecca for the best surf in the world. And prior to going, I studied a phrase book. I went to the library, got language tapes, and then I went over to the University of Miami and met with some Indonesian students. That experience, just that 45 minutes with a student, opened up a door. I ended up in Bali and cut my foot and decided to go see the rest of the country and go to Jakarta. Someone gave me a letter to give to a cousin. As a result, I ended up traveling all over Jakarta, the temples of Borobudur.
With a little Bahasa Indonesia to help you.
Bahasa, Abasadada. I walked to the surf expo over this past weekend and walked up to a group from Uluwatu, Bali.
Yeah.
And I said, Apa Sidada, Dapa Pachata, Bahasa English. And the people, they opened up, they beam. It opens up such extraordinary opportunities and relationships. People I've met in 1984, I still converse with. So I would say to all those that have never considered a language, if you plan to travel, it's so extraordinary to be able to converse and see the reaction of people who would least expect you to take the time to learn their language, and I can't encourage it more.
Joe, you put it
and
so
I'm
well.
And I disagree with Mr. Summers.
Okay, duly noted, and you put it very, very well. I mean, the way that world opens up, Marty Abbott, it really is exciting when you cross that line and suddenly you're connecting. I mean, over the years, I've, like Joe, learned some Bahasa Indonesia and just a whole now kind of rusting yard of German and Telugu and Cantonese and Japanese. But at that moment where you make the connection, it's tremendously humanly exciting, Marty.
It really is, and that's what we need to do as Americans is engage with the rest of the world. It's not just about learning, just a few phrases, but as the caller said, actually interacting with the people and understanding their perspectives, and that's going to inform us as Americans about how to do business around the world and how to do diplomacy around the world. So that's absolutely necessary, and I do want to say that we are welcoming what was considered the non-traditional student into language classrooms at the K-12 level because the focus is on communication. And since everyone learned a native language, they are certainly able to learn a second language. I just think we have to get over that national psyche that we're not good at languages.
Let's go to Brian in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about machine translation. One thing that I've been working with is site called Maidan.org, and what they do is they take machine-translated articles that are translated from original language into machine translation, and then they have natives go back and clean it up so that articles that are available around the world are able to be read in both Arabic and English.
So it may not be the last version that the machine does, but it gets them a good distance of the way there. Brian, thanks for that. Clive, there's a little sort of man-machine hybrid work on translation there.
Absolutely. In fact, I think one of the things that is really exciting about machine translation is that it gives people enough of a window into what's going on mm-hmm. that it can stoke that interest to go the extra mile. I speak and read pretty bad French from being Canadian.
Yeah.
I'm in the process of trying to learn Spanish, and one of the things that's really cool is that you can sort of try reading stuff online on your own, and then you can look at the translation to see if you're getting the gist of things. These tools, if you actually have the interest in it, can help push you further faster. And even people that are not particularly interested in learning it can at least get a glimpse of what's happening around the world. Because, you know, for example, I use Chrome as one of my browsers, and it has an auto translation built into it. So if I go to a Dutch newspaper, it just automatically translates into English. And this has the aspect of remarkably opening up my news reading habits in a way that was never before possible.
Software giving you a leg up and maybe getting you hooked. Let's go to Sri Kuram calling from Boston. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm the president of the Boston Language Institute, and as I've been listening to the conversation, I want to share two things. With respect to business, one of the things we've learned over the decades, we've come from a time where the assumption was if they want to do business with us, they'll speak English, mm-hmm. to the realization that while you can buy in any language, you sell best in the language of your customer.
Yes, I can hear that. And what else, Kalam?
And the other thing that we've noticed is a big change in the military focusing on teaching their people foreign languages. And we've come from a time in the mid-60s when, according to William J. Lederer, there were only 12 people in the United States who spoke Vietnamese.
Wow.
And that ignorance of the language and therefore also of the culture led us into a great catastrophe. And we've come to a time now where the Air Force, the Army, the Navy sends us people from San Diego to study languages like Farsi, Arabic, Chinese, Russian.
Because they need it, which is...
I see that as a great growth.
I appreciate your call and pointing out that precisely that need. Marty, where do you see the biggest driving pro-language learning coming for today? What's the force out there? Is it government these days? Is it just individual families looking at a globalized world? Is it just young people who somehow get the bug?
Yeah, I tell you, it's coming from families of young children. Parents at the elementary level are really driving the issue with their local schools, and they are important advocates. And we actually just published a book, Raising Global Children, by Stacy and Marshall Burden, and they talk about how important it is as families to get students ready for this global environment in which they're going to live and work. So I think that's definitely a driving force. And we're hoping with our campaign, a public awareness campaign that we're going to launch in September, Lead with Languages, that we can get the government involved as well.
Clive, what's your guess going forward here? Technology comes in and gradually erases this need, requirement for language learning, or maybe even enhances our interest in it?
It's never gonna decrease the need for it at the high level, if you want to speak and think. But I think, in one sense, Sumners was right about the rest of the population, the folks who are not going to put the work in to learn a new language, which is probably a significant chunk of the public. Those folks are going to have exposure to things being said and done in other languages like they never have before. So in that sense, he's right. He's wrong about the top end, but he's absolutely right about the big chunk of the iceberg floating under the water.
Well, high end, great utility right across the boardwalk, and great satisfaction no matter what you learn. I'm for it. I encourage it. Clive Thompson, contributing editor at Wired Magazine. Always great to hear from you. Thank you for joining us today, Clive.
Glad to be here.
and Marty Abbott at the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. Good luck to you, Marty. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael Geisler, Middlebury College, thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.